32. One morning, as I was having breakfast with Rolf and Wendy, a tall, shirtless figure came ambling towards us.
"We're honoured," Rolf said. "Bigfoot Clarence, chairman of the Cullen Council."
The man was dark-skinned and rather pear-shaped, and his feet were enormous. I gave him my chair. He sat down, scowling.
"So how's you?"
Rolf asked.
"Right,"
said Clarence.
"Good." "They're past the budget in Canberra,"
Clarence said in a flat, disinterested voice.
"Oh, yes?"
"Yep,"
he said.
"We've got the plane."
For over 2 years now, the Cullen Council had been angling for a plane.
"Yep," Clarence repeated. "We've got the plane now. Thought I'd tell you."
"Thanks, Clarence."
"Thought I'd go to Canberra Thursday," he said. "Thought I'd come back in the plane."
"You do that," said Rolf.
Clarence got to his feet and was walking away when Rolf called him back.
"Clarence," he said.
"Yep."
"Clarence, what have you done with the grader?"
"What grader?"
"The Popenjee grader."
"Don't know no Popenjee grader."
"Yes, you do,"
Rolf said. "The grader Red Lawson lent you."
"When?"
"Last year," he said. "You and your mates went hunting on that grader, remember?"
"No."
"Well, Red's coming over to fetch the grader. I suggest you find it, Clarence, or they might deduct the cost from the plane."
"Don't know nothing about a grader."
Clarence sneered angrily and stamped off. I caught Wendy's eye. She was trying not to giggle.
"That plane," Rolf turned to me, "is going to be trouble."
It was all very well to give them a plane, another thing to pay for its upkeep. None of the Cullen mob saw the least point in having a plane unless they had the plane right there. That meant paying a pilot to live at Cullen. It also meant a child-proof hangar. At the Amadeus settlement, Rolf continued, the pilot had been a nice guy who liked to take the kids for a spin, kids of 8 and 10, and they soon got wise to the plane's control systems. They watched where he kept his keys, in a locked drawer in his caravan, and managed to nick them while he was taking a nap.
"He woke," Rolf said, "to watch the aircraft moving down the runway."
"They took off?"
"Not quite," he said. "Overshot the strip and landed in some bushes. The plane was a near wreck."
It was still cool and bright in the early morning. "I thought I'd go for a walk today," I said. We were expecting Arcady any day, and each morning at work in the caravan, I promised myself a walk up Mount Liebler.
"Take water," said Rolf. "Take 3 times the water you think you need."
I pointed out the way I planned to climb.
"Don't worry," he said. "We've got trackers who'd find you in a couple of hours, but you must take the water."
I filled my water flask, put 2 extra bottles in my rucksack, and set out. On the edge of the settlement, I passed a lady's handbag hanging from a tree. I walked over a plateau of sandhills and crumbly red rock, broken by gulches which were difficult to cross. The bushes had been burnt for game drives, and bright green shoots were sprouting from the stumps. I was climbing steadily, and, looking down at the plain, I understood why Aboriginals chose to paint their land in pointillist dots. The land was dotted. The white dots were spinifex, the bluish dots were eucalyptus, and the lemon-green dots were some other kind of tufty grass. I understood, too, better than ever, what Lawrence meant by the peculiar, lost, weary aloofness of Australia. A wallaby got up and went bounding downhill. I then saw, on the far side of the chasm, something big in the shade of a tree. At first I thought it might be a giant red, until I realized it was a man. I shinned up the far side to find old Alex, naked, his spears along the ground, and his velvet coat wrapped in a bundle. I nodded, and he nodded. "Hello," I said. "What brings you here?" He smiled, bashful at his nakedness, and barely opening his lips, said,
"Foot walking all the time, all over the world."
I left him to his reverie and walked on. The spinifex was thicker than ever. At times I despaired of finding a way through, but always, like Ariadne's thread, there was a way through. I next fell for the temptation of touching a hedgehog, to put my hand on a clump, only to find my palm was stuck with spines 1 inch or so before I'd expected. As I picked them out, I remembered something Arcady had said.
"Everything's spiny in Australia. Even a goanna's got a mouthful of spines."
I clambered up the screes of the escarpment and came out on a knife edge of rock. It really did look like the Parenti lizard's tail. Beyond, there was a tableland with some trees along a dried-up watercourse. The trees were leafless. They had rumpled grey bark and tiny scarlet flowers that fell to the ground like drops of blood. I sat, exhausted, in the half-shade of one of these trees. It was infernally hot. A short way off, two male butcher birds, black and white like magpies, were calling antiphonally across a ravine. One bird would lift his beak vertically and let out three long whooping notes, followed by three ascending shorts. The rival would then pick up the refrain and repeat it. Simple as that, I said to myself, exchanging notes across a frontier. I was lying spread-eagled against the tree trunk with one leg dangling over the bank, swigging greedily from the water flask. I now knew what Rolf meant by dehydration. It was madness to go up on the mountain. I would have to go back the way I'd come. The butcher birds were silent. Sweat poured over my eyelids so that everything seemed blurred and out of scale. I heard the clatter of loose stones along the bank and looked up to see a monster approaching. It was a giant lace monitor, the lord of the mountain, Parenti himself. He must have been 7 feet long. His skin was pale ochre with darker brown markings. He licked the air with his lilac tongue. I froze. He clawed his way forward. There was no way of telling if he'd seen me. The claws passed within 2 inches of my boot. Then he turned full circle and with a sudden burst of speed shot off the way he'd come. The Parenti has a nasty set of teeth, but is harmless to man unless cornered. In fact, apart from scorpions, snakes and spiders, Australia is exceptionally benign. All the same, the Aboriginals have inherited a bestiary of monsters and bugaboos with which to menace their children or torment young men at initiation time. I remembered Sir George Grey's description of the Bolias, a flap-eared apparition, more stealthily vengeful than any other creature, which would consume the flesh but leave the bones. I remembered the rainbow snake, and I remembered Arkady talking about the Manu Manu, a fanged, yeti-like creature which moved underground, prowled the camps at night, and made off with unwary strangers. The first Australians, I reflected, will have known real monsters, such as the Thylacaleo, or marsupial lion. There was also a Parenti lizard 30 feet long. Yet there was nothing in the Australian megafauna to contend with the horrors of the African bush. I fell to wondering whether the violent edge of Aboriginal life, the blood vengeance and bloody initiations, might stem from the fact of their having no proper beasts to contend with. I dragged myself to my feet, climbed across the ridge and looked down over Cullen Settlement. I thought I could see an easier way down, which would avoid having to cross the gulches. This easy way turned out to be a rock slide, but I arrived at the bottom in one piece and walked home along a stream bed. There was a trickle of water in the stream, and bushes grew along it. I splashed some water over my face and walked on. I had raised my right leg to take a step forward and heard myself saying, "I am about to tread on something that looks like a green pine cone." What I had not yet seen was the head of the King Brown about to strike, rearing up behind a bush. I put my legs into reverse and drew back very slowly. One, two, one, two. The snake also withdrew and slithered off into a hole. I said to myself, "You're being very calm," until I felt the waves of nausea. I got back to Cullen at 1:30. Rolf looked me up and down and said, "You look quite shattered, mate." Rock-a-bye, baby, on the treetop. When the wind blows, the cradle will rock. When the bough breaks, the cradle will fall, and down will come baby, cradle and all. That man is a migratory species is, in my opinion, borne out by an experiment made at the Tavistock Clinic in London and described by Dr. John Bowlby in his Attachment and Loss. Every normal baby will scream if left alone, and the best way of silencing these screams is for the mother to take it in her arms and rock or walk it back to contentment. Bowlby rigged up a machine which imitated exactly the pace and action of a mother's walk, and found that providing the baby was healthy, warm, and well-fed, it stopped crying at once. The ideal movement, he wrote, is a vertical one with a traverse of 3 inches. Rocking at slow speeds, such as 30 cycles a minute, had no effect, but once you raised the pace to 50 and above, every baby ceased to cry and almost always stayed quiet. Day in, day out, a baby cannot have enough walking, and if babies instinctively demand to be walked, the mother, on the African savannah, must have been walking too, from camp to camp on her daily foraging round, to the waterhole, and on visits to the neighbours. Apes have flat feet. We have sprung arches. According to Professor Napier, the human gait is a long, lilting stride, 1, 2, 1, 2, with a fourfold rhythm built into the action of the feet as they come into contact with the ground. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, heel strike. Weight along the outside of the foot, weight transferred to the ball of the foot, push off with big toe. The question occurs to me, and quite seriously, how many shoe soles, how many oxhide soles, how many sandals Alighieri wore out in the course of his poetic work, wandering about on the goat paths of Italy? The Inferno, and especially the Purgatorio, glorify the human gait, the measure and rhythm of walking, the foot and its shape, the step linked to the breathing and saturated with thought. This Dante understands as the beginning of prosody. Ossip Mandelstam, Conversations about Dante, translated by Clarence Brown. Melos, Greek for limb, hence melody. And think this, slow-packed soul. John Donne, The Second Anniversary. A white explorer in Africa, anxious to press ahead with his journey, paid his porters for a series of forced marches. But they, almost within reach of their destination, set down their bundles and refused to budge. No amount of extra payment would convince them otherwise. They said they had to wait for their souls to catch up. The bushmen, who walk distances across the Kalahari, have no idea of the soul's survival in another world. When we die, they say. The wind blows away our footprints, and that is the end of us. Sluggish and sedentary peoples, such as the ancient Egyptians, with their concept of an afterlife journey through the field of reeds, project onto the next world the journeys they failed to make in this one. London, 1965. The man who came to supper with Mr. Rasik was a scrubbed and balding Englishman, pink as a healthy baby, and in his middle 60s. He had sandy to greying sideburns and clear blue eyes. His name was Alan Brady. You could tell at a glance he was a very happy man. Mr. Rasik was the official buyer in London for the Sudanese government. He lived in a flat on top of a tower block in Victoria. He had a hennaed beard and wore white jalabayas and a floppy white turban. He was never off the phone, collecting punters' tips for horses, and apparently never went out. Occasionally you heard the sound of his women in another room. His friend Brady was a travelling salesman for a firm that made typewriters and office equipment. He had customers in about 30 African countries, and every 4 months would visit each in turn. He said he preferred the company of Africans to white men. It was a pleasure to do business with them. People said Africans were impossible to deal with, always wanting something for nothing. "But let me tell you," Brady said to me, "they're a whole lot easier than my colleagues in the office." In 20 years of trading, he had had 2 bad debts. He never took a holiday. He was unafraid of revolutions or African airlines. He came to London 3 times a year, never for more than a week, and would stay in the bunk room the company set aside for its travellers. Because he had no winter clothes, he tried to time these visits to avoid the worst of the weather, in November, in March, and again in July. Apart from the clothes he stood up in, he owned no possessions other than a spare tropical suit, a spare tie, a pullover, 3 shirts, underwear, socks, slippers, an umbrella and a sponge bag. Everything fitted into a suitcase he could carry as hand baggage. "I don't believe in wasting time at airports," he said.
Every time he returned to London, he went to a tropical outfitter's off Piccadilly and completely re-equipped himself. Suitcase, umbrella, clothes and all. He gave the rejects to the office porter, who made a few pounds on them.
"Nothing," he said proudly, "wears out on Alan Brady."
He had neither English friends nor family. Mr. Rasik's flat was the one place in London where he felt at ease. His father had been gassed at the Somme. His mother had died during the week of Dunkirk. Sometimes in the summers he used to visit her grave in a village churchyard near Nottingham. He had once had an aunt in Wigan, but now she too had died. He was past retiring age. There were murmurings among the office staff that it was time for him to go, but his order book was always full, and the management kept him on. "Don't you have a base?" I asked him. "Don't you have anywhere you could call home?" He blushed with embarrassment.
"I do," he faltered. "It is rather private."
"I'm sorry," I said. "Forget it."
"Not that I'm ashamed of it," he went on. "Only some people might think it's silly."
"Not me," I said. He said that in the office safe, he kept an old solicitor's black tin deed box, the kind of the estate of Sir Somebody So-and-so, in white lettering. Whenever he came to London, he would lock himself in the bunk room and spread the contents over the mattress. In the bottom of the box, he kept the bric-a-brac salvaged from an earlier existence, his parents' wedding photo, his father's medals, the letter from the king, a teddy bear, a Dresden kingfisher that had been his mother's favourite, her garnet brooch, his swimming trophy. By 1928 he no longer had attacks of bronchial asthma, his silver ashtray for 25 years loyal service to the firm. In the top half of the box, separated by a layer of tissue paper, he kept his African things. Worthless things, each the record of a memorable encounter. A Zulu carving bought off a sad old man in the Drakensbergs, an iron snake from Dahomey, a print of the prophet's horse, or a letter from a boy in Burundi thanking him for the present of a football. Each time he brought back one new thing and chucked out one old thing that had lost its significance. Alan Brady had only one fear, that soon they would make him retire. If every newborn baby has an appetite for forward motion, the next step is to find out why it hates lying still. Penetrating further into the causes of anxiety and anger in the very young, Dr. Bowlby concluded that the complex instinctual bond between a mother and her child, the child's screams of alarm, quite different to the whimperings of cold or hunger or sickness, the mother's uncanny ability to hear those screams, the child's fear of the dark and of strangers, its terror of rapidly approaching objects, its invention of nightmarish monsters where none exist. In short, all those puzzling phobias which Freud sought to explain but failed could in fact be explained by the constant presence of predators in the primeval home of man. Bowlby quotes from William James's Principles of Psychology, "The greatest source of terror in childhood is solitude. A solitary child kicking and yelling in its cot is not, therefore, necessarily showing the first signs of the death wish, or of the will to power, or of an aggressive drive to bash its brother's teeth in. These may or may not develop later. No, the child is yelling, if you transpose the cot onto the African thorn scrub, because unless the mother comes back in a couple of minutes, a hyena will have got it." Every child appears to have an innate mental picture of the thing that might attack, so much so that any threatening thing, even if it is not the real thing, will trigger off a predictable sequence of defensive behaviour. The screams and kicks are the first line of defence. The mother must then be prepared to fight for the child, and the father to fight for them both. The danger doubles at night, because man has no night vision and the big cats hunt at night. And surely this most Manichaean drama of light, darkness, and the beast lies at the heart of the human predicament. Visitors to a baby ward in hospital are often surprised by the silence. Yet if the mother really has abandoned her child, its only chance of survival is to shut its mouth.